Gather round, one and all, and listen to tales of excitement and adventure. Tales of daring heroes, savage monsters, and bards who just couldn't keep it in their pants. Tales of friendship, nobility, drunken foolishness, and unforgettable fun. These are tales of role-playing games, fair listeners, and this is Rollin' Bones. My name is Ryan Howard, and I shall be your guide. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Rollin' Bones with Ryan Howard, your source for the best in RPG interviews. I am your host and King of the Boneheads, Ryan Howard, and we are joined today by a creator who some of my friends have been begging me to bring on the show for over a year now, almost since the very beginning of this thing. People have been clamoring for this guest, so ladies and gentlemen, and by ladies and gentlemen, I mean Josh Unruh, please welcome to Rollin' Bones, the co-creator of Band of Blades, Strash Achimovich. There we go.
How's it going, folks?
Absolutely. And I have had half of a glass of whiskey, so thankfully that didn't hamper my ability to pronounce your name at least somewhat correctly.
It's better than most folks, so, you know, I'll take it.
All right. Cool. Well, Strash, thank you so much for agreeing to come on the show. We're going to kick this off the way that we kick off every single episode of Rollin' Bones. I've got these questions here that everyone gets asked. So, Strash, let's begin at the beginning. How did you get into RPGs?
Actually, it's a pretty funny story. I think it has to do with this box right there. So when I was a kid, I still remember we were actually not local at the time. We were living in India at the time, and my parents, they asked me what I wanted for Christmas, and they handed me this catalog, and I picked out Hero Quest, and it's this old little Bradley board game. And they told me that it was like expensive to ship big boxes or something. And they asked me if I wanted some other presents, I could get two of something else. But I was like, no. And they made me wait a year. And then when they showed up the next year, I was like, Hero Quest. And so they got it for me. And I ran it for some kids local there. And after we played all the adventures in that, I started inventing stuff. So I think a lot of my roots come from just, you know, kids playing games and coming up with stories. Mm-hmm. And then I had but my actual first role-playing game that I ever played was a friend of mine out there. His brother actually ran first edition Warhammer in French for us. So I've been playing games a while, and it's been like a weird and storied road. I've played all sorts of stuff. I didn't come down the usual path. So yeah, that's how I ended up in gaming.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you've been playing in several different languages as well, so...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Definitely. Yes. You'll actually see that that's a theme in a lot of our games. Is there's a lot of semi-multilingual content, or at least jokes that people who speak other languages might pick up on.
Gotcha. Now, I take it from that early story about having to come up with Hero Quest adventures on the fly that very early on you found yourself in the forever GM role. Is that accurate to say?
Yeah. I mean, I think you're saying it like it's a bad thing. I think that every game needs, you know, both GMs and players. You can't have a game without both. And I just, in that case, I happened to be the kid with the rules, who knew the rules, and I was kind of running the game for everyone else. So I would say that during my career, I've GM'd maybe 75% of all the games that I've been in. Mm-hmm. But especially lately, that's definitely not been true. I've met some wonderful GMs. I've gotten to play a lot. Sorry about the sneaky plug here, but if you watch actual play, you'll see me actually in a number of games. I'm in the game with Judd Carlman on that. He's GMing. So So yeah, I've played in my fair share of games, but I've also run a fair amount. I don't know if Forever GM is accurate, and even if it is, I don't mind too much. I have fun on both sides of the table.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with being the Forever GM until there becomes something wrong with being the Forever GM. It's a day-by-day thing. Fortunately, I find myself in a position right now where I am just playing after a long stretch of being the GM, so it's a nice break. At some point, I'm just going to get bit by the bug again and insist on running a game for someone.
I think that there are so many good games with so many good tools out there right now that, I don't know, if something inspires you and gets your imagination flowing, it's a great way to cut loose and sort of share it with your friends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I got these stacks of games over here that I'm the only one who has, so...
Yeah, I know that feeling.
Yep. If I want to play it, I better run it. Now, moving on from there, you've mentioned that you've played several games over the years, all kinds of different ones. If you had to pick a favorite, what would that be?
So I don't actually buy into this whole concept of favorites because it has this imaginary quality, right? I stopped counting how many games I played around the three digits because there's no point after a point.
Yeah.
And I think that... one of the things that's awesome about sort of the era that we live in is that there are so many vastly different games, and you can't really compare some games. Like if you play, you know, some D&D and you play some Monster Hearts, those two are radically different games. How do you decide which one's your favorite? I think that they just fill very different niches. They fill very different needs. And I don't know. I mean, like there are certainly games I play more often than others. And there are certainly games that in the past I've played more often than others. So I'm not sure really like what criteria to apply to favorite, but obviously I've been doing a lot of hacks of Blades in the Dark. This is something I keep coming back to just because it's so fluid and it's so easy and it's so well integrated, the mechanics and fiction. So it runs very much the kind of action adventure genre that I crave. But I've been running a lot of it and I've been playing a lot of it, different hacks of it. That's definitely probably tops in the last several years in terms of play time for me, but, doesn't mean anything. I play games that I fall in love with. And, then obviously if someone else is running it, I then bring it to my home table and we switch things up and so on and so forth. So that answer kind of changes week to week, depending on whatever I'm infatuated with and running at the time. I don't know that I would say necessarily that I'm flighty so much as I fall in love with a lot of games and I play a lot of games. So which one's favorite just depends on which week you ask me.
Absolutely. I'm familiar with the feeling. So
sorry, I've got a little fuzzy here. Loves attention. She's not sure why I'm not paying any more. Go on.
Oh, we have to name the cat or Elfie will get upset with me. So what's the cat's name?
Oh, this is Gigi. It's a little gray tabby. Aww. That I've had for a while now.
Let's see. I am catless right now, so they are both in other rooms. And yes, Elfie loves her, because Elfie loves all cats. So, going back to those early days, I know with you know, a game like HeroQuest, it's a little bit different than, say, a traditional RPG. But if you can remember your first RPG character or your first memorable RPG character, who was that?
Ratcatcher, Warhammer First Edition.
Nice.
I remember we had to roll characters, and I was so excited until somebody told me that I was a ratcatcher. I thought it was the worst thing ever, but then it turned out to be awesome. I had a small but vicious dog, and turns out that dog saved the party several times. So I got to be the hero, and it's... I think it definitely has influenced my desire to not always play the sort of like bombastic larger than life heroes in every game I play. I oftentimes find some of the more bizarre or like less heroic templates equally fun. So yeah, so that's definitely probably the first character that I played, you know, straight up RPG that's memorable for me.
Gotcha. Now, we have just been joined in second chair over here by Nora, so I will turn the camera here so that everyone can see the lovely Norwegian Nora trying to get at my desk. Now, being someone who ends up running a lot of games and, you know, ends up GMing, like you said, 75% of the time, a lot of us who, you know, GM a lot, there are some NPCs that tend to hop from game to game. So, Strosh, do you have a forever NPC or an NPC that makes a lot of appearances?
I don't do that. I think for me, you know, I have a number of friends, and I'm not judging this super hard, so like don't take this the wrong way. I have a lot of friends that actually like have a concept that they make over and over and over again, or they have a type that they play that's almost like, you know, every game that you're in, you know, you're gonna be the big beefy fighter or whatever, and there's nothing wrong with that. But yeah, for me, I think I'm one of the things that's really a joy about games is that for the most part. I love the idea that we take a character and we put them in a story and then we tell their story. And then when we're done, we kind of put it aside. So I'm very much familiar with Cid appearing in every Final Fantasy game. So I know the stereotype that you're talking about here. But for me, I don't actually have anything like that I necessarily glom onto or try to insert in multiple games. I feel like every game's a chance to come up with something fresh and new. Now, that doesn't mean that maybe I haven't gone to a specific trope once or twice, like, especially after running so many games, but it's definitely not intentional. It's not something I look out for. I don't have stories of, you know, an Elminster or a Bigsby or whatever. It's not my style.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And then Inglewood Armory in the chat here, who's Josh, the friend of mine who's been lobbying really hard for me to get you on the show. One thing that he wants to point out that he loves about Band of Blades is the fact that the game itself has an ending, like you mentioned.
That's very important to me. Yeah. I would say that I only make two kinds of games. I either make games that are suitable as one-shots so that you play them and then you can stop anytime. Or I make games with endings. Scum and Villainy has an ending. Band of Blades has an ending. Every game that I play is going to have an ending. I think that that's actually very important. I think that one of the things that's unsatisfying about some like more traditional, like older school RPGs, you know, your vampires and your pathfinders and whatnot. They just kind of have this like kind of theoretical implied end that people just do not like gaming groups don't last long enough to meet like a 1-30 campaign run. Mm-hmm. Those of you that have played that, I do not begrudge it to you. You know, congratulations, you have won. But like, most gaming groups don't survive that many years.
Oh yeah.
And then a lot of times it's kind of unsatisfying, right? Because you play until stuff just sort of falls apart, and it leaves you in this like weird state where you kind of want to know the ends. You want to kind of see like what happens in the story. You want to know. And among other things, I think that, like, particularly as I've gotten older, and it's just one of the things that's part of my life, it's easier to tell people, like, hey, it's going to be a bit, we're probably going to have to play 12 sessions, but at the end of those 12 sessions, the story will be done. Can you sign up for that? Like, it's very upfront. It tells you where it is. It's not going to drag on forever. It's not going to drag on past the point where it's fun. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's like a really important topic, is that you know that there is an exit point. And you know that you're gonna have a time to like do it, digest it, and then move on to something else. And I think that that's actually something that a lot of games don't talk about, and mm-hmm. it's unfortunate because if you don't teach people how to make satisfactory endings, or you don't help them, right? Like one of the things that I also believe in is like GM tools, right? And mm-hmm. and trying to help the GM to tell a good story, or giving them as many things as you can to sort of like make things easier for them.
Yep.
And yeah, I think this is just an extension of that, right? Like helping them know how to pace things because they know when the end is coming or are able to estimate it, even if it's not exact. I think is helpful because like it lets them set stuff up, think about like appropriate endings, you know, and sort of pace things out correctly. So, mm-hmm. Big fan of games like Dread and whatnot that have even an integrated like you can hit the button and end the game at least for yourself anytime. kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's always good to have kind of that ultimate end state in mind, whether you're creating your own homebrew adventure or, you know, running a game like Band of Blades that has an ending. Because, I mean, I was lucky enough to one time play in a game for 3 years and then GM a game in that same kind of 3 year time period where both campaigns ended up going to level 20, but I was in college at the time, so I was not going anywhere. Other people don't have that kind of time to invest in a single game, or, you know, will lose focus and not necessarily want to stick with something that long. So yeah, having something with a definite ending that you can measure out is definitely a value proposition, especially in a world like we live in now, where there are just tons and tons of games out there, all kinds of possibilities, and a whole bunch of fickle people like me who see things and think, that looks awesome, I want to run that. And then after six sessions, something else looks awesome, I want to run that.
Very familiar with this feeling.
Absolutely. Now, you've alluded to it a little bit as we've had this discussion here, but if you had to describe your playstyle, both as a GM and then as a player, how would you describe that?
Oof. Good question. I think GMing wise, I tend to be very cinematic. So I talk about stuff in a very kind of like from the lens of a TV show. Like a lot of times they'll say like, oh, if this were a TV show, we'd see the camera pan like this and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Things I really like doing is I like asking players very difficult questions through the lens of the game. So I'll put difficult choices in front of their characters and see what they do. That's a fun thing. I like asking people what they care about in a way. You'll see this particularly like if I'm running something like Scum and Villainy, is I'll make a couple of jobs and I'll see which one sounds interesting to the players. And if they reject certain ones, I'll ask similar questions with different factions and whatnot and check and see like how they feel about stuff and where the line is for them and so on. So that's pretty fun. I'm big into making sure that my tables are comfortable. So I like, you know, player input. I like consent. I like checking in with everyone. That's a thing that's, I guess, part of a GMing style.
Yeah.
I also, sorry, there's a mosquito. I like things that are, striking, bold, loud. I like getting to the good bits. I like big action adventure scenes. That's mm-hmm. definitely elements. I like giving people space afterwards to breathe and sort of process and talk to each other too. That's actually like where I get to make popcorn and watch the PCs talk to each other. That can be fun. So yeah, I don't know. It really depends on the game. I listen very hard to what a game is trying to tell me it wants to see, and if that sounds like a really fun set of scenes and sort of like feels and whatnot, then that's definitely something I'm going to be interested in. So yeah, I don't know. That's a tough question to ask. It's like, what is your GMing style? It's like, I don't know. Yeah. I like keeping pace high. I like some action adventure. That's usually my sweet spots. As a player, I'm not into this whole immersion thing super deep. I do like having some meta input now and again. For the most part, though, I like making characters that, you know, I leave some room for them to surprise me. Mm-hmm. I like seeing what a character makes choices with, and then I try to stay authentic to it and sort of see where that leads and develops. That's fun for me. I'm definitely, I've played so many games that I don't have like a set format. A lot of times, like when we're making a group, I'll ask, oh, what's everyone else making? And then I'll pick to fill. Like I usually pick last in our groups because I don't have a strong stance on stuff usually. Like if I do, I'm like, hey, I don't want to be X, but other than that, I'll play anything. Mm-hmm. I'm very flexible. I've played like I don't have a set type. I play characters that are, you know, quiet and mousy. Currently, I'm playing in an Aegon game. I'm playing a trickster who's a descendant of Hermes, and I'm dropping puns and one-liners and just being super jokey and kind of It's really funny because, like, the last Islander leader was a Scion of Ares. So, anytime, you know, their brow would get all thundery, I'd make some, like, quick wise crack and defuse the situation, stuff like that. So, it varies. Like, on the other hand, I was mentioning the game with Judd on Saturdays. I'm kind of the shit kicker of the group. So, I'm like, beefy McBeefyson with the hard hitting. So yeah, it like varies. It depends on what the party needs. It depends on what the party comp is. A lot of times I'll take a look at what might be an interesting piece to add. So like in that game in particular, we have like the claimant, we have a very talky kind of political, very like reserved like priest advisor. So I thought that we needed kind of like the more straightforward kind of face your enemies and go head on type to add to the mix. So yeah, you play enough games, you stop necessarily having a specific type. You just start trying different things. You get out of your comfort zone a little bit, and then that becomes your comfort zone. So you get out of that a little bit, and eventually you just end up playing all sorts of stuff. So depends on the game, depends on my mood. it changes. I don't know what kind of player I am. I'm afraid you would probably have more luck asking my GMs. They would have more input than I do.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, this next question can be a bit of a toughie because, you know, people who come on shows like this, people who make these games and put time and effort into this hobby, we all have a lot of fond memories tied up in being at the table. So I'm going to ask you to pick between your children and tell me what your fondest RPG memory is.
Yeah, the problem is this phrase favorite. Like every game I play will usually have one or two gems. Which one I remember on any given day is varies very deeply.
Okay.
So yeah, I don't know. This is a, you're right. This is a toughie because if you have like over a couple of decades of games under your belt, you have a lot of trouble trying to figure out which ones are better than others. I've had so many experiences. Like I really can't tell you, you know, like it's not that I'm trying to be secretive. It's just that every week I play in some stellar games. I have to admit, like the players that I'm playing with are just absolutely awesome. And so when you're playing with top notch players, like, it's hard. It's not even about children. It's about just like when you try to reach back and you're like, which one shines brightest? You're just covered in this ocean of input where like you just remember a thousand different things, all of which seems to be like the best or super fun or great. Like, so I can tell you stories about small slice of life archipelago games that I played, you know, late night at Gen Con. I can tell you about, you know, big bombastic battles in our home run of Band of Blades. I can tell you about, you know, even from decades ago, everything from like vampire LARPs to like, you know, D&D adventures to whatever. Like I've played so many games and I've had so many good games that it's just impossible to try and pick out the best or favorite. So sorry.
It's all good. It's great that you mentioned, you know, playing with such great players. I mean, I've had that experience with my Wednesday group. I'll say that even with Josh here in the chat, you know, you guys are fantastic and I love playing with you every week. It really is great to have those games where you're with all of those, you know, fantastic people. Everyone seems to have a place and everyone has this thing that they do super well, and the stories almost blur together in that they're all so great and so fun. So yeah, that is a good problem to have, if indeed you can even call it a problem.
Yeah, I don't know if that's a problem, but I definitely I agree. Mm-hmm.
Now, speaking of problems, unfortunately we've got to sink the airship a little bit because while we do play the game with all kinds of people, some of these people end up being our best friends, and, you know, we create fond memories with them. Some people we just don't click with, and then there's a certain subset of people that we end up sharing the table with who kind of ruin the whole experience. So, Strosh, if you have a that guy story that you are comfortable sharing on the show, please go for it.
I'm not gonna lie. From my friend group, I'm kind of the, I guess you'll call me the adventure someone. I'm definitely the person that I go to more conventions than most of my friends. I'm willing to run for absolute strangers. I've had many good experiences. Actually, a lot of the people that I game with now are people that I've met at cons. I have this tendency to stitch communities together. But I was actually super fortunate that early in my gaming career, somebody actually sat down and we had a conversation about agency and also about like, it's like table culture and, yeah. and understanding that some things are table problems. So I don't actually have a ton of those stories because if I'm not jamming with someone, if someone's like throwing a wrench in the works and the game isn't working, I'll either talk to them or I'll just boot them or not game with them. That's just a decision I made a long time ago. And there have been spells in my life where I've done very little gaming. Fortunately, now we have like the internet and Roll20 and everything is like set up and easy. But as recently as like 10 years ago, Roll20 wasn't around and that was just not an option. So yeah. Like if you were in a town and, you know, you weren't jamming with a group and it was the only game in town, you only had two options, one of which was don't play.
Yep.
And what I realized was that having everybody kind of like be comfortable and happy at a table is more important to me than just having a game, no matter how good it is or how bad it is, or no matter how bad it is, I guess is the question of right now. Yeah, I mean, I've had, I still remember the last time I GM'd, the last time I GM'd a D&D game was I just had a guy who was like an absolute rules lawyer, and I was just like, look, you're winning the fight. Why is this important? And the thing is that sometimes, yeah, you'll run into those kinds of people, but that's not, that's the thing that's handled out of game. And like I said, I learned early on that that's sort of where that belongs, is you just discuss stuff with people like outside of game. And yeah, I've been really fortunate. Like I self-select. I tend to make games out of people that I already know I'm going to kind of be jamming with. So like a lot of times they'll then bring their friends. They'll just be like, hey, Strauss, you want to play a game with us? And I'll jump into that game. So I have this like incredibly broad network of very high quality players that I'm friends with that, you know, it makes it pretty easy to not have, like the last person I say that I was regularly gaming with that I didn't have a ton of fun with was 2005, 2006. So it's been a while. It's just, I don't have too many horror stories. I mean, most of them are in the era of like high school when I, you know, we didn't really understand how to have that kind of discussion. And we fell under a lot of those gamer fallacies where it's like, well, if we aren't compatible as gamers, then we can't be friends, or like friendship equals gaming. And if you don't invite someone, then you hate them. And none of that's really true. Sometimes people are just really terrible to have at a table, but they're fine otherwise, and vice versa. So like, actually less vice versa, but that specifically, I've had some friends that I'm friends with who just either aren't gamers, or like when they game, like we don't jam particularly well. I've had some people that just like chaos and saying random stuff and like don't really pay any attention to the narrative or coherency in the story. And so sometimes like that just doesn't work for me, because like I do like having characters and interactions and like a good story. And so like it's about just like picking a table that has similar goals and agendas and like moving forward. So yeah, I guess this turned into this turned a little preachy. I'm gonna cut it there, but
all good.
I don't really have that guy, like terrible that guy stories, largely because the last time I had that guy stories, I was like 14 or 16. And so like, yeah, it's just one of those things. Like eventually you just outgrow it. Or if you don't, maybe that's something to look into. So yeah, that's kind of where I fall. Sorry.
No problem. Now, so far I've asked several questions that have been difficult to answer, and unfortunately I have to say this one has been one of the most difficult questions for people to answer on the show. And I'll tell you, Strosh, the answer to this question can be as philosophical or as sophomoric as you want it to be. So, if you could put anything on a t-shirt, what would it be?
I think Harper made my talk shit roll crits quote. So I actually am fortunate because I actually have the t-shirt with my quote on it.
Nice.
I guess this gets back to your question about like what kind of gamer are you? It's like, well, talk big, then roll the dice and see if they back you up. And if they don't, that's why we play games with dice. So yeah, I think that's as close as I get to that. We're also fortunate that actually John, who's my design partner, not Harper but LaBeouf Little, does silk screening. So actually we've made a bunch of shirts based on games and ideas that we've had. I picked up layout when we started working on our first book, and so I've actually made some t-shirt logos and stuff. So yeah, I'm a little bit more fortunate than most, I think. I have ended up with some t-shirts that are printed with this kind of thing. So
Yep. So it's you and Skeeter Green that have your quotes on t-shirts that are available to the public.
I guess we're just lucky. So
Absolutely. Although Skeeter's got kind of out of hand. Oh, that goddamn exec meme is great amongst the Frog God people. Have you ever been to a gaming convention, like a smaller one, and seen people wearing t-shirts that say, "God damn it, Zach"?
no.
Okay. Gotcha. So it hasn't grown that much. Basically, what happened there's a the I think he's the COO of Frog God Games, Zach Glazer. He and a bunch of the designers at Frog God were in a group chat, and Skeeter Green, who has worked with Frog God and done some stuff on his own. He basically just kept everything that would happen. He just kept going, "God damn it, Zach." And then he put it on a t-shirt and started selling it. And then people who, like had friends named Zach would get it and give it to their friend Zach. And so
I see.
it was one of those things that just kind of got out of hand. And eventually Zach was walking around seeing people wearing the shirt who he didn't even know them. He had no idea who they were. And he's like, "Why are you wearing the shirt that was intended as a joke on me?"
I think actually I have a funny story in this similar vein. I still remember this was like when I hadn't quite yet gotten into indie games as much. And I saw a bunch of people wandering around Origins that had a t-shirt that said, "Ask me about God." And I was like, oh no, they're gonna try and, sell me on some satanic panic nonsense. And I was like, I'm not sure about this. So like I was avoiding them. And then a friend of mine convinced me to go to Games on Demand, and I noticed a bunch of people wearing these shirts, and one of them was someone that I knew from elsewhere, and I knew, he was cool. So I walked up to him, I'm like, "Man, I gotta ask you, why do you have that shirt?" And he's like, "It's ask me about Games on Demand." I'm like, "That's not how anybody is gonna read it." So yeah, that's a similar, sort of like, why do you have that shirt story? So yeah.
Yep. Now, Games on Demand, if you guys want to maybe potentially get in hot water over copyrights, but have another great reference shirt like that, you could make one that says, "Tell me all your thoughts on Games on Demand."
I should know that reference.
It's a song from the 90s by Dishwalla, Counting Blue Cars. The chorus
Oh,
goes, "Tell
okay.
me all your thoughts on God."
I see. I see. I see. Yeah, it's probably not that litigious if you expand it. So,
Yeah, I don't even know if
yeah.
that band's together anymore. So, any Dishwalla fans or members of the band, feel free to get in touch with me and set me straight if I'm wrong there. So, we are through the introductory questions. So, let's dig into some of the stuff that you've done here. Of
Sure.
course, we have to talk about, the two big ones, Scum and Villainy and Band of Blades. So if you had to give just like a quick elevator pitch for both games to someone who's never heard of them, never heard of Forged in the Dark, how would you do that? What would that be?
I mean, the back cover pitches are pretty solid. Scum and Villainy is pretty easy. It's space adventures, pew pew, right? It's got strong roots in things like Cowboy Bebop, Firefly, just an old 90s anime cartoon called Outlaw Star.
Yep.
That's kind of big. It's a game about space opera. It's a game about larger than life characters living in kind of like an edge sector of space and trying to make ends meet. You're kind of a semi-criminal crew in space, and you're going to get involved with factions more powerful than you, get in trouble, make some enemies, make some friends, and you know, see sort of where the winds take you and how you can affect the galaxy. That's pretty much it. Band of Blades, very different game. It's a military dark fantasy. By military, I mean you're playing the remnants of a company after a failed war. It's dark because it has a lot of horror elements to it. It's got undead and dark magic and terrible things that are arrayed against you. And obviously it's fantasy because I said the word magic, but it's very low magic. It's very much like people sort of like in the mud with grit and like dealing with stuff, not having a lot of magic on their own side. And so, yeah, that's, they're very, very different games. Yeah.
Gotcha.
That's the pitch.
Awesome. And to get, just kind of on the subject of Band of Blades, it's interesting that you mention horror, being a, you know, kind of a big part of Band of Blades, because they're really, honestly, even if you take away the monsters and, you know, the dark stuff and the magic that even you and your soldiers don't have in a game of Band of Blades, the ultimate horror concept is this idea of being outnumbered and surrounded on all sides. And, you know, honestly, there's very few things in life more horrifying than that feeling of isolation. So it's definitely interesting that you bring up the horror concept there.
There's this thing that I have to blame my design partner for some of this. My design partner really likes asking a lot of questions before we start designing a game. He'll really, really kind of dig into stuff. And one of the things in particular that we had discussions about before we worked on Band of Blades is sort of, there's 1,000 fantasy games out there. What makes this one different? Like, what are you pulling on? Why is it important? What do we need to put in? What's kind of like the beating heart of this? And one of the things that I talked about is the fact that there's actually a fair amount of military games out there, but very few of them tell the kind of stories that, you know, I sort of grew up hearing from my family and sort of like integrated into my memories and sort of what I studied. And a lot of this comes from like World War I, World War II. And it's particularly in Europe. And this makes a very different, this makes for a very different story, right? Like one of the things that people keep asking me, and I keep telling them that's not this game, is they're like, all right, so this seems very grim and dark. How do we make it like heroic? How do we be the heroes? How do we like go up against Cinder King? And I'm like, that's not this game. You clearly don't understand where this is coming from. So let me suggest some other games. There are plenty of games out there that'll help you tell that kind of story, but that's not this one. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think it's just, and for me, I think that war has a lot of horror, but I think that it helps to be like one step removed. I think that a lot of people, of course, get like historical panic. I know I do. I hate playing games that are set in an actual period of history. That particularly if you're playing with someone that knows a ton about that period of history, it's one of my nightmare scenarios. So yeah, this in particular, like the fantasy element changes everything. It means that decisions that you make aren't already like locked in historical fact. And it helps kind of like take a step back. We're pretty straight up in the text. We talk about how the enemy generals each have themes. Many of these themes are horror themes, but many of these are also like historical themes, like, you know, authoritarianism and fascism and things like that. And so you get to decide what you want to put in your game. You definitely need to talk with your table before you put in the game. And I think that actually while I was writing it, one of the things that I discovered was I was actually talking to John about this, is the fact that I grew up with a lot of you know, European fairy tales in my childhood memory, and so a lot of my fantasy ends up being darker, just because that's kind of like the kind of stories that were integrated into sort of like my core fantasy milieu, my tone, my whatever you want to call it. And so so that's something that when I put in the game, I was like, oh, actually I kind of see where some of this is coming from, because like if you read a lot of like the grim fairy tales and stuff like that, a lot of them end up being not very happy or funny or, you know, lighthearted. And so it's just something that consequently I kind of brought to the game. And so yeah, that's where a lot of the horror elements come from.
Absolutely. Do you know Luca Reyes at all?
Not off the top of my head, no.
Wizard Thief Fighter. That's what he is on Twitter, and that's his website, his company.
I'd have to Google it. I don't know it off the top of my head, sorry.
So the reason I bring him up, he's Slovenian. And a lot of that same approach I see a lot in his work as well. Just the kind of European folklore aspect, kind of making things a shade darker, and how that informs games. I see that a lot in the games that you've put out, and it seems like you and Luca could have some interesting conversations around how that informs your writing style.
I'll definitely have to look him up. You'll see that a lot in sort of like regional stuff over there. I don't know how much you follow like RPGs that are from overseas.
Only a little bit. I'm only really familiar with the stuff that comes out of the UK, and then like Free League stuff from Sweden.
Okay. Yeah. There's actually a lot of interesting RPGs that are starting to happen all over the place. I'm fortunate that I have some friends that hook me up with stuff, whether it's like, you know, sort of the other direction. I've seen stuff that's popping up in Japan and whatnot, which is very different. And then there's actually some stuff there's a lot of stuff that's happening in Europe that we're actually seeing some stuff transfer over. I think like The Dark Eye now has like an English translation, stuff like that. So like, yeah. I think you'll find that if you kind of dabble your fingers into a bunch of that stuff, you can see it in video games. A lot of studios from over there will have some of those tones and themes and certain stuff there. But yeah, it's not uncommon. I think it comes from, you know, historical context and sort of the stories you're fed as a kid. So
And a lot of that's actually getting some cool, you know, mainstream visibility because of, you know, the popularity of the Witcher series and you know, games like Kingdom Come Deliverance and stuff like that crosses over and has even just kind of left behind the Eastern European roots that it comes from and really kind of taken hold in the minds of people in the US and beyond that. I didn't know what a Leshen was until Witcher 3, and now I'm obsessed with them.
All right. Are you talking about a leshy? Like yes. like a forest spirit, like a forest critter?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Made oftentimes portrayed as having like tree parts or plant parts. Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Nice.
Yeah. In the short time that I've been aware of the leshy, I have thrown it against two different RPG groups.
Oh, I see. I see. This is kind of like a East European folklore meets the Monstrous Manual kind of scenario. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, sure.
Absolutely. And then one thing that Josh brings up in chat here, since we mentioned the game Band of Blades has a definite ending, there's also a definite lose state within the game. So why don't you talk a little bit about that and how it's very possible that when you set out on a game of Band of Blades, you ultimately may not be successful.
So I think that I guess I'm not gonna point fingers here. I'm just gonna talk broadly and generally. How's that? I think that in particular, I have a statistics degree among other things, and so for me, numbers are like I can oftentimes like look at dice pools and like resources and stuff like that, kind of make Like I'm very good at like Euro board games. Like they feel like math homework frequently to me, but this doesn't mean that I can't process them pretty efficiently. I think that there's a lot of games that lie to you, and they will tell you that you're in danger when you're really not. There's plenty of games that actually only work off of like a limited set of resources disappearing from your pool, as opposed to actually threatening, you know, the characters. And I think that it's very hard to tell stories about heroism if you're never in any real danger. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with telling a different kind of fantasy. I think that if you want to have characters that are going to win and you want to play big damn heroes, as it were, that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. There are plenty of stories like that on television where we know that people aren't really in danger because they're not really going to die because, you know, they're the heroes, right? Like they're going to make it. We know that because we know that, you know, it's a big name hero with a contract and this is a classic Hollywood action movie and that's how it's going to end. But I think that in particular in role-playing, this is again, just one of those questions. It's like, what have I not seen in games? What makes this game different? And that was one of the things that I wanted to make sure was in there. Now, I will say that it's not like a coin flip. It's not 50-50. Like good player decisions will definitely push the percentage higher than that by a fair margin. But yeah, you can still lose. Like in particular, if you get unlucky, you can lose. Some of the best stories I've heard of Band of Blaze are campaigns that fail. And one of the most epic ones, I just recently read, the group reached out to us and told us the story. It's they failed right before Skydagger Keep. They made a bad bet. They rolled crit. Their time clocks filled up and they were done. It was real bad luck. And they lost literally one step from winning. And they sat around and they talked a little bit. And what they decided was, yeah, you know, they're going to honor the fiction. They're going to let that happen. And they made character sheets for each of the commanders and they played one last session where they saw how the last of the Legion died and like all of them died by the end of it, but they made a heroic last stand. And I was like, you folks really get this game. All right. Kudos. Thank you so much. I'm glad that it did a thing for you. But yeah, it's I think that you have to like, it's just part of that story. It's like, if you want to play a game where, you know, you're heroic and you know that at the end of the day, you're gonna pull the day. This is not the game for you. Play something else and that's okay.
Yeah.
And I don't think that every game should be like that. I think that Scum and Villainy is much, 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 much higher on the like player survivability and kindness angle because space opera is a story of big damn heroes. You can still lose in space opera, but you should feel confident that your GM's not gonna let you down, that if you get captured and the mission fails, it's okay because the next episode is going to be an exciting escape from prison and you're going to somehow make it out and then, you know, make it right or whatever. Whereas in Band of Blaze, that's not true. You can and you will lose. It is absolutely possible. So and I think that that's important. I think it's important to know the odds and to sort of like stare the possibility of loss in the face and try to wrench victory out of that, because that's kind of like what cool heroic stories are told about. And it's, I don't know. It's a different sort of game. And I think that it needed that. And I definitely respect the games where you can actually have like a failure state as opposed to a failure state that kind of doesn't change the status quo. Like you miss, nothing happens, right? Like that's not my jam. I think that anytime you pick up the dice, you should put something on the line and there could be bad outcomes and that's okay, because if rolls don't matter, then why are you rolling? And so that's the kind of game I gravitate towards. This is the kind of game I tend to design. Yeah
absolutely. And even like taking a step back even from the creative side of things, which is definitely like a major driving force behind this. Even if you just look at the RPG market purely from a market standpoint, to make another fantasy game, even a lower fantasy game where you have heroic characters, is just one more of those. Whereas on the other side, you know, what you're looking at with a game where you're not heroic and there's a good possibility that you're going to die, there's a much lower number of those. So being able to make noise in that direction and draw attention to that kind of storytelling and to encourage people to, you know, kind of change their mindsets when it comes to gaming is really kind of a brilliant thing, even coming at it from the creative side and kind of backing into that particular factor of making an RPG like this.
I have to admit, I'm actually really bad at kind of understanding marketing slash trying to design. I don't design games sort of like for. I do think about the audience in the sense that I make a game for a specific type of person.
Yeah.
And I think I specifically make games for me. I play game. So one of the things that I tell anybody who's thinking about getting into game design is don't try to be an artist. Don't like necessarily try to make a game that's not fun to play, because if you want to make a game that's worth like playing, you're probably going to have to play test it. And if you're going to play test it, chances are you're going to have to run it. So you should make a game that A, you like to run, and B, that you like to run 100 times, because you're going to be playtesting it a lot. And if you go to a con, people are going to want you to run your game and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So like, I make games that I like running. I make games that I like seeing people play in, and I make games that are fun for me. And I happen to be fortunate that some of those games are also popular with other people, because I tried making games for the sake of like where I tried to anticipate what a generic gamer might want, or like think about markets and stuff. And what ended up happening is it turned into a job, and I kind of hated it, and I stopped wanting to make games entirely. So then I threw that in the garbage can, and I just stuck with what I know, which is like make a game that's fun. And if you happen to make choices that people don't like, it's okay, because not every game is for everyone. And there's hundreds of games out there. So just pick whatever you like. And I'm not going to judge you if you don't like my game. There's a comic book author I really like who kind of slammed one of my games. And I was just like, it's cool. You don't have to play it. Still like comics, you know, because I think at the end of the day, what's really awesome about gaming right now is the fact that there's a game for everybody. Mm-hmm. And so, I wish I could tell you that it's a sneaky marketing decision and how we were super clever and all this stuff. But no, it's just, I really wanted to make this game. And then my co-author was like, okay, what's exciting about this game? And he helped me kind of like pick out the pieces and kind of narrow it down and make it really focused and sharp. But for the most part, it's just, I listen to a lot of metal music. So, you know, you can see like, oh, okay, there's some elements of that in this one. And there's, you know, other elements of different things in this one. And it's just whatever I'm kind of, there's a lot of games that I start making because my group at home says, hey, we kind of want to play something like this. Can you make something like that? And I'll just slap a game together and we'll have a game in like a week or two. And so this one though was a little bit of a passion project. It's something that I thought about a little bit before, but yeah, we kind of sharpened it and kind of figured it out and got the details right. And so went from there, but it's definitely not because it's what the market wants. I can promise you that it's not the kind of thing that I worry about. It's the kind of thing that my publisher might worry about, but I just make whatever it is that me and my groups want to play. So, yeah.
Yeah. And honestly, that's the way to do it, because the best RPGs is a business where your passion very much shows in the work that you're doing. And if you are, just to use an example, I love the movement of OSR, so I'm not crapping on anyone here. But if you just kind of, you know, do an OSR game because you realize that is, you know, selling.
Popular.
Yeah. Pan Atheist, thank you for following. If you put something out, like if you put out a 5th edition rule set or something like that, just because that's what people are buying, not necessarily because it's something you yourself want to do, it's going to show through in the text. Yeah. So it really is a matter of, you know, finding what you're passionate about and putting that out there, even if the audience is, you know, 20, 30, 15 people who, you know, are just really into this idea. At least someone, you know, liked it and saw your passion in it.
I think that that's important if you're not. I think that there's also a difference in approach, right? Like, when I say indie games, what I actually mean is like, I guess I'm going to define it as like creator owned.
Yeah.
So like even though Evil Hat publishes some of these games, all of the like IP and the writing is done by me and John.
Yep.
So I think that the difference between writing for someone else and writing for yourself is that if you're a company like Hasbro, then market penetration and marketing is very important to you. Mm-hmm. And you hire people that can write to the strengths of that. For whatever definition of that is for you, I know a lot of people disagree on what's good, what's bad there. But at the end of the day, it's not the individual writing that gets to make a lot of these decisions. And I know that in particular, one of the reasons why I'm attracted to indie games is because I can write the things that I want to write. And I think that it generally means that as much as all of us really wish that some of these wonderful indie games had a bit more visibility and a bit more like, you know, wider appeal or can reach a broader audience, I think that ultimately you have to decide why you're making games. And to me, it's exactly like what you said. It's to make sure that the 15 to 20 other people that are very like-minded very much like it. Although I will say that we've been incredibly lucky. For reasons that I'm not entirely clear on, Band of Blades kind of exploded. And it's been doing really well for us. But more importantly, I'm seeing groups that I never would have imagined playing it. There's a big kind of streamer group from Spain that's playing it right now. So my incredibly rusty Spanish has been talking back and forth. And one of the things we discovered is that memes are a very efficient form of communication. So I'll ask them like how their mission went, and they'll post the meme like in return. And I'll absolutely howl. Like my favorite is they had a mission where one of their units went out to do something. And in return, they angered Blighter, but they didn't understand that that's what they did. They were just like executing a completely unrelated mission in their minds. And so somebody posted the like two ladies yelling and the cat sitting in front of the salad and just like put the little like squad logos and stuff on top of it. And I was like, I absolutely understand exactly what happened on that mission. So,
yep.
So yeah, it's kind of amazing actually to see, especially because like Band of Blades actually just finished funding in Korea. So we're going to be getting a Korean copy shipped to us.
Sweet.
But it's interesting because the different cultural approaches also means that people run slightly different games and kind of like really absorb it and sort of run it in very specific ways. And seeing how like different groups of people have been playing it has actually like really been kind of gratifying, because I can tell that it definitely, the people that love it really love it. Like they go all out. There's a Polish group that actually just got to Skydagger, and they've been posting. Apparently they have like a couple of professional grade artists on their team. And so they've decided that in order to convince the GM not to murder all of their characters, they're just going to do awesome art of all of them and make the GM fall in love with them. So that it's like really hard for the GM to kill them. Mm-hmm. Stuff like that. It's just, it's amazing. Like as an author, as somebody who's making these games, I never imagined how many or who is going to be interested in this stuff. I just kind of start working on it, and then I have to have faith that if I believe in it enough, other people will also happen to like the things that I like. And so seeing absolutely like these groups and like their faces and pictures of their tables and like the giant maps that they print out, and like there's like people that make little flags and stuff and put it on the map and burn section the map as like, you know, the Cinder King's armies advance and stuff. It's wild. Like it's stuff that I could never have imagined, and it is the single most like gratifying thing, right? Like you suffer a lot making a book, and at the end of the day you're like, was this worth it? And the moment you see some of those photos, you're like, oh, absolutely. There it is. That's all that I wanted, is somebody gets this the way that I get it. It's like making a painting and not being sure if people are going to feel the things that you feel. And you know, like it's like that. It's like seeing these groups playing this is just, it really warms my heart. It means a lot. It means a lot. And the photos shared are kind of amazing.
Yep. Yeah. And you just know with a game like this, there's someone out there who's got their Grognard army set up on their map, and they're using one of those like unit mover stick things that you see in World War II movies to move their units around. And Josh just brought this up in chat. The way that this game came onto my radar is long before I started gaming with Josh and that group. They were running a, I believe it was a Pathfinder game that basically ended up with them in command of an army, and Josh noticed a lot of parallels between what you have set up in Band of Blades and what ended up happening with his world, and so he's getting ready to run, like he says in chat here, a homebrewed reskin with the characters from that old Pathfinder campaign in the position of the commanders, dealing with, you know, what's going on in Band of Blades, again, with just everything kind of switched around to fit the lore that they're in. And so there's a lot of cool potential for stuff like that. If you find that your campaigns take kind of a military bent to them and you find yourself in dire straits, I feel like this is definitely something that you can use to change it up, even just using the mechanics and the scenario and changing the names of the units and stuff like that. I feel like that gives this game a lot of good utility.
I think you'll see that actually we kept some of the stuff like really simple. So like a lot of the undead generals and their units are basically just fictional. We don't have stat blocks and stuff like that. So swapping some stuff out, I think is probably easy, but more importantly, one of the things that we really wanted was for people to be able to kind of put their take on it. There's certain things that are factual about those units, but there's a lot of stuff that comes from sort of like interpretation and like kind of how the GM sees it. So I think that lends itself pretty well to some of the stuff that you're talking about there. I know the guy that did our website, Randy Ost, he's running a book series I haven't read. So anyone that's a fan, please forgive me. It's not that I hate it. It's just that I've recently gotten introduced to it and I have piles of books to work through. So I think it's called Black Powder Mage series or like Black Powder Mage Fantasy or something like that. And he was really into those books, and then he discovered that like it's a really good fit. So I know that he wrote kind of like a reskin that utilizes a lot of that world and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I've heard of a couple of people doing stuff like that. It's interesting. It's hard to have common ground to talk about because like obviously if you're playing in a completely different world and I only know the core Band of Blades rules, we don't have a lot in common to chat about. But it's yeah, it is. A couple of times I've seen people do some stuff that I'm just like, interesting. Okay, they're like, cool. You're making that work for your game, which, you know, two thumbs up, do the thing. So, yeah.
Gotcha. Now, this game and then, you know, Scum and Villainy as well, they both kind of come out of another game that we've talked a lot about on the show. I've reviewed it. I had John on a while back. That is, of course, Blades in the Dark. And you've mentioned, you know, coming back to different Blades in the Dark hacks. Do you have kind of a wish list of things you want to see come out of this kind of Forged in the Dark imprint or of different genres of games that could spin out of what John has there with Blades in the Dark?
So I've actually written kind of like blog posts and stuff about this. I think that the power of Blades in the Dark is sort of this wedding between fiction and mechanics, which I think is super important. Most of the hacks that I've seen actually cleave very close to core Blades in the Dark. Some of them are just reskins with like, you know, just a tiny sprinkling of something. Some try to go a little bit further afield and I think this is sort of like the early post-apocalypse world era where one of the things that I try to do with my designs is sort of showcase some of the steps that you can take to like move away from Blades in the Dark. I think that there's a lot of people actually that tell me that they're like, oh, Scum and Villainy is just a reskin. I'm like, no, it's not. But one of the things that I came to realize is that a lot of our bigger changes are kind of cloaked. Like we use a lot of the same formatting. A lot of it looks very close to core Blades in the Dark. And it is closer than Band of Blades. Like Band of Blades just like outright kicks, you know, certain things apart and just very plainly like makes completely different sheets and sets up the GM, gives them a playbook just like everybody else and distributes GMing tasks amongst the table. And there's all sorts of like fun stuff there, I think. As for what I want to see, that's a really tough question. I think it goes back to I think what I want to see is stuff that I don't know that I want to see, because what I get a lot of joy from is just like reading something and being like, oh, I never would have thought about that. That's a really cool idea for a hack. I'd love to play that. And so like sometimes you see stuff that you're kind of like, oh yeah, that's probably, yeah, I can see how you could do that. And sometimes those are great hacks too. So like there's no slams, but it's tough to have a wish list because my wish list is stuff that I couldn't think of myself. Which is kind of a cop out, but it's true. I love playing stuff that, and I've seen some stuff that's like super wild. There's a hack right now that's on Kickstarter, I think, where you're fighting immortal vampires, and instead of playbooks, you have like these masks that you fuse with your face that give you powers or something. Like, I don't know. There's people are doing some really, really cool stuff. I think that as long as you maintain that core, as long as you keep that integration between fiction and mechanics and don't stray too far from that, I think that there's a lot of stuff you can do. I think that in particular, Blades in the Dark is really strong for action-driven, kind of cinematic, like very vibrant on-screen, you know, characters that have the resistance mechanic allows you to push the fiction and see what bad things could happen and then snap it right out of the jaws of defeat. I don't think that it's great for a lot of like introspective internal stuff, maybe. It's definitely more of a TV show vibe rather than like a, you know, philosophical narrative vibe. But yeah, there's a lot of cool stuff happening. And the thing that I'm most excited about is seeing the generation after the first generation of games, right? Because I feel like we're right at the end of the first generation of games where a lot of them are just using it, seeing that it's able to be done. A number of them are being kickstarted. We're seeing some books come out and stuff like that. I'm lucky because I got to be involved with the beta process very closely. So I was playing Blades in the Dark years before everybody else, you know, got a copy via the Kickstarter and whatnot. So it shouldn't be a terrible shock that even though we're very busy beavers, John and I managed to put out some books a little bit ahead of the curve. I'm just excited to see what folks are doing. I think that, like I said, we're in the middle of that first wave where we're seeing a lot of, you know, clones and hacks and people experimenting with different stuff. But I expect that the second generation, the next iteration of this, is going to push limits and break rules in ways that I couldn't anticipate. I'm going to see, you know, what like we've seen this with, you know, things like Apocalypse World, right? Where like the first couple of generations are very, very similar to the core. And then it starts going more and more further afield. And in particular, as people like add new mechanics and solve certain problems, like other people reuse those pieces to make new stuff and then add their own. And so just like the progressive growth of design, the progressive sort of like expansion out there is really what I'm excited for, is seeing all of the cool ideas that, you know, people are throwing out there. it's actually a super, super exciting time. I don't know if it's a big movement yet. I don't know if it's, there's a lot of people that tell me that it hasn't quite taken off as much as some other things, but I don't know. I see a lot of activity on the forums. I see a lot of activity in Discords. I'm seeing a lot of games getting kickstarted. So like, I don't know. We'll see where this ends up. Like, sure, PBTA has like, is it 5-10 years on Blades, but the stuff is cooking, and there's some really bright designers that are taking cracks at it. It's always just time and familiarity, right? Like, if you play a game, sometimes it'll just like galaxy brain, and then you'll just you know, immediately want to make something of your own. And sometimes it takes a while, like just until you internalize the mechanics and play through some stuff, and then your home table wants to play something weird and you just glue it together, and then you start adding systems that match that idea, and then all of a sudden you realize, oh well, I have a little bit of a game, maybe I'll publish this, I don't know.
Absolutely. I mean, Josh mentions pirates, which seems like a pretty good I'd be hard pressed to imagine someone not already trying to jump on that and make some kind of Fortune in the Dark Pirates game at this point. Seems pretty tailor-made for that. Personally, I can see Cyberpunk actually being pretty cool for this.
I think most people, well, I've seen a couple of takes, but I think most people are waiting for Null Vector, which is Harper's cyberpunk take. It was one of the stretch goals. I know it's in the pipeline somewhere. Just Harper's a very, very, very busy person.
Yes.
Plus the apocalypse is happening, which, you know, kind of kills the productivity of a lot of people. So no blame there at anyone. But yeah, I know it's been tough on my end as well. John and I were putting out like 1+ small games a year, and now it's a little bit tougher to do that kind of stuff. I'm working kind of on a big game right now myself, so we'll see. Maybe next year there'll be another Force of Dark game that gets kicked out there.
Absolutely.
I think a lot of people are waiting to see kind of what happens with Null Vector, but I know that there have been other kind of cyberpunkish games that I've had hot takes done in that style, different hot takes, like everything from Hello World to I'm not going to read an email, but it's I think cyberpunk is pretty well suited. Maybe with 2077 coming out in November, we'll see both the people that are trying to make old cyberpunk games anew and people who are angry at old takes on cyberpunk having new cyberpunk takes anew. So I'm excited to see what kind of happens when there's that big sort of, I don't know, I guess when the term's in the zeitgeist again, I'm not sure what to call it. So I'm expecting we'll see a bunch of cyberpunk hacks probably next year.
Yeah, absolutely. So. And then two that seem kind of obvious to me, but I don't know if anyone would actually have put the time into making these. A Wild West version, a Forge in the Dark Wild West game, I'd be down for, just because I love Western stuff. And then, and this one someone's probably done, has to have been, because it's so close to the original idea, but like 1930s Prohibition Gangsters also seems like a layup for this.
I'm checking. If you're looking for a Weird West game, I think A Fistful of Darkness is out there, and there's a couple of other ones.
Well, I mean, I'm a huge Deadlands fan, so if I want my Western fix, I will force someone into playing Deadlands. And you mentioned not liking playing super historical games with people who know the history. You would hate Deadlands games.
It's a little different, though. Yeah, Deadlands has some other troubles, mostly from the era in which it was written, and some hot takes on cultural stuff from that particular time period. But
it has been updated though, and a lot of that stuff has. Yeah, the Kickstarter for the Adventures Edition ended back in May. The PDF for the new updated version is up now, and basically, within the meta of Deadlands, the Civil War ended in 1871, so a lot of that stuff is gone by the time of 1886 when you're actually playing the game.
Maybe I'll check it out. I played a lot of Deadlands. Oh, it was a long time ago. Actually, I wouldn't say a lot. I played some Deadlands, and there was a card game that was associated with Deadlands.
Yep.
So I'm familiar, but. I never really got into the. I think there was there a D20 version. Back me up on this.
Yeah, there was a D20 version.
Yeah, I kind of avoided that one, and I do have a copy of the. There was an in between one using the my brain these days. I haven't played a lot of this, but it uses. It's the other. I forget, but there was another version using a different game engine. That happened in between, and I know I backed that one, but I haven't seen it. I haven't seen this latest one, so maybe I'll have to check that out. But there are actually a couple of Weird West or Wild West PBTA takes that I've seen. I don't know if I've seen specifically Prohibition Era, but I know that there's a couple of like moonshiners, kind of rum runners, sort of like. Stuff that's out there. Copperhead County is the one that I'm thinking of off the top of my head. Yeah, you know, there's a lot of times when people are like, you know what would be great? And I'm like, ah, there's already like three of those.
Yeah.
And it's like, check out these, see if any of them fit your palette. And if not, you probably had them pretty closely, like directly across, without too much effort. So yeah, I don't know that I've seen exactly gangsters. I know that there was a Italian mafia, dueling mafia stretch goal that actually some Italians were going to write. That was on the actual Blades Kickstarter. I don't remember if there is like an early draft of that album or not.
Gotcha.
So yeah, there's actually a shocking amount of Blades hacks. It's just their biggest problem, I think, is just that a lot of people haven't heard it. But I think that because I'm so involved with the community, I'm kind of keeping track of that.
Yeah.
So like, I happen to like, I'm like, oh, do you want a Weird West Blades hack? Check out Fistful of Darkness. So you know, it's one of those things where yeah, there's a lot of ideas that have already been processed.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Actually, I'm curious to see what. You know, if you were to make a hack, what that would look like. So
now has anyone done like a G.I. Joe type, kind of like 80s cartoon military type?
I think it's situation. I think it's a little too bright for Blades.
Mm-hmm.
Blades of the Dark actually. So actually I noticed somebody in chat said this. I'm sorry, Twitch chat. I'm actually creeping you here. Somebody said like Depowered by the Apocalypse. Actually, I want to set the record straight. Blades is a PBTA game. It's not just Harper being esoteric and putting the logo on, thereby accomplishing all the legal ramifications that Vincent Baker has asked for. It actually is a PBTA game. Like if you look at the core mechanics, they're actually moves. And if you think about it, that's kind of a big part. It just doesn't have a lot of the familiar trappings like. You know, specifically like core moves aside from the core mechanic one, the action roll. But I think that Blades in particular, among other things, you can fail a roll, right? Like you can roll a 1-3, that's straight up fail. Hmm. And that's not a thing that's going to happen in a G.I. Joe cartoon.
Yeah. Yeah. And like And I guess more what I'm thinking would be along the lines of like the G.I. Joe comic book where it's a little bit more, you know, the stakes are a little bit higher. People actually can die and bad stuff like that happens. Not necessarily something like the Saturday morning cartoon where the plane explodes and you see the parachute.
I think that if you want to look at that kind of genre, I think that you'll probably have slightly better luck with Fate. Because it's specifically designed to emulate that. And in particular, I think they actually did Shadow of the Century, which is specifically 1980s themed and brings all of those tropes and stuff in. So that might be fun to check out. Yeah, I'm not 100% sure if how good a fit Blaze is going to be there, because a lot of that stuff has to have things that don't happen in order for us to keep them like verisimilitude of the backstory of,
oh yeah,
you know, these guys, the good guys always win and they save the day and we have commercial breaks and kids with little planes and stuff. So, it gets a little tricky. I'm not sure how good a fit it is. Blades, you can lose in Blades and that's a tough sell for some genres.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I could see someone taking kind of a darker spin on G.I. Joe, and I'm even right now trying to think of like the core concept of how to get a G.I. Joe type concept into the Blades formula and make it where those stakes are high, where you can lose, where you ultimately you know, Cobra will win if you screw up, and the consequences are more dire than just, you know, it looks like we're going to lose right before we go to commercial or something like that.
One of the core questions that Blades asks of a given character and player is, what are you willing to pay in order to do something, right? Because, like, between resistance roles and other stuff, characters can be narratively quite potent, but you're risking things like trauma and a lot of times you can, when you pick up the dice, what you're really saying is like, what is the bad thing that you're willing to happen in order for you to do this? And I think that's in the bright color, in the four color universe of Saturday morning cartoons, I think that's not necessarily something that we see as a question asked very often.
Right. Yeah.
That might be a question that's asked on something like Gargoyles, but those dark Saturday morning cartoons are kind of rare, so I don't know.
Absolutely. Cool. So we are kind of running up against what's usually the end of our time. So what I like to do in this time is kind of turn things over to the guest, for anything you've got to promote. And I know, Strauss, you do actual plays and some streaming stuff in addition to your game. So whatever you've got coming up, anything you want to plug, go ahead. It is your time.
I am probably bad at this whole marketing thing. So yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Strash A. That's a place where I talk about games and game design mostly. Every once in a while, you'll see like random nerdy stuff leak out. I talk about TV shows and so on and so forth. I am, after all, not just a gamer. I also stream on twitch.tv/actualplay. As a matter of fact, right now we're in a Forge in the Dark game. We're playing Rebel Crown. It's a game where you're basically playing like a claimant to a noble house that's trying to fight, like ferment a rebellion slash fight a war to like seat themselves on a throne. And one person plays the claimant, the rest of the players are playing like a supporting cast. It's got like a little bit of a I think it's fraught if you say a phrase like it's got a Game of Thrones vibe. I don't think that's actually true, but maybe sort of like in concept as opposed to it's in execution. So yeah, we're playing that. It's pretty fun. Judd Carlin's running. I've got like a couple of great players that are with me. Lauren and Luke, both stellar players. I think actually Lauren's in chat. Yeah, so if you're interested in something like that, check us out. We play different games. Like I tend to stream Saturday nights, but also stream various other shows on actual play. So yeah, that's that. I guess the only thing that I'm gonna say is I'm working on a new game. So if you follow me on Twitter, you may hear me occasionally talk about it. It's called Spell and Blade. It's a fantasy Forge and Dark hack, kind of high fantasy, like much more action adventure slash, I guess high fantasy stories is pretty much exactly the pitch. So yeah, that might be some, if you're interested in something like that, follow me and hopefully you'll get some news and we'll see where that goes.
Gotcha. And just to shout out one of the members of the audience who's consistently on stream here and interacting and participating in the conversation. Out of the Loop in chat is streaming her art basically the entire month of October. She's been streaming multiple times per week, so if anyone wants to see some cool drawings and interact with her as she's going through some of these Inktober challenges that people have been doing, Out of the Loop, as you can see in chat, she is doing all kinds of content. The other night she drew Fantasy Costco, which we had a long discussion about. Because I don't really like going to the real Costco, so Fantasy Costco seems like a whole nother level of nightmare, depending on what you could run into there. But yeah, that is on her channel, so everyone check that out. Just to update everyone on what's going on this week, this Saturday morning on Danishes and Dragons, I'm getting back to some character building. We're still going to be in 5E this week as I am building a battle bard and explaining, what kind of melee bards are out there for anyone who, is interested in playing a bard but still wants to swing a sword or an axe around. And then next Monday, we are actually doing a makeup from what was last week because Greg from Nord Games kind of messed up the times there. We've worked it out, and he will be on next week to discuss their Ultimate Bestiary Kickstarter, which is quickly coming to a close. So if you want a whole bunch of orcs, goblins, and hobgoblins, you'll want to tune in and hear all about what Nord Games has going on their Kickstarter. Until then, guys, though, whether you rolled a 1 or a 20, I'm so glad that you rolled your bones with me, Ryan Howard, and I'll see you next time.